I hate to tell you this, but it turns out that traditional bed sheets can harbor more bacteria than a toilet seat. I know, very disgusting. Not only is it extremely gross, but it also leads to acne, allergies, and stuffy noses. Miracle Made offers a whole line of self-cleaning, antibacterial bedding, such as sheets, pillowcases, and comforters that prevent up to 99.7% of bacteria growth and require up to 3 times less laundry. If you get hot at night, you'll appreciate Miracle Made's self-cooling properties, which makes use of silver-infused fabrics inspired by NASA. If it's good enough for the astronauts, it's good enough for me. They are thermoregulating and designed to keep you at the perfect temperature all night long. It makes a huge difference in getting better sleep every night. If you hate sleeping in bacteria, which I'm sure you do, or you're looking to get rid of your worn and uncomfortable bedding, you should check out Miracle Made. You'll feel like you're tucked into a luxurious hotel fancy bedding situation, but it'll be a lower cost than some of those other brands. Go to trymiracle.com/thestacks to try Miracle Made sheets for you or a lucky loved one. Order today and save over 40%. Plus, if you use our promo code THESTACKS at checkout, you'll get 3 free towels and save an extra 20%. Miracle is so confident in their product that it's backed by a 30-day money-back guarantee. If you aren't 100% satisfied, you will get a full refund. Upgrade your sleep with Miracle Made. Go to trymiraclemade.com/thestacks and use the code THESTACKS to claim your free 3-piece towel set and save over 40% off. Again, that's trymiracle.com/thestacks to treat yourself. Thank you, Miracle Made, for sponsoring this episode. Welcome to The Stacks, a podcast about books and the people who read them. I'm your host, Tracy Thomas, and today we're back for another installment of The Stacks Book Club. We're going to be discussing The New Wilderness by Diane Cook, and our guest is Van Newkirk, a senior editor at The Atlantic and the host of the Floodlines podcast. Our conversation delves into the world of climate disasters through the story of The New Wilderness, and we've got plenty of spoilers today. So please read the book before you listen. Be sure to listen until the very end of this episode because I will also be announcing our book club pick for March. If you love this podcast and being able to discuss books you read with other book lovers and generally believe in supporting the work of artists you appreciate, consider joining the Stacks Pack on Patreon. That's a website that allows you to make monthly contributions in exchange for perks, things like our virtual book club, discounts on merch, and shout outs on this show. If this sounds like you, head to patreon.com/thestacks and join. This week's shoutouts go to some of our newest members, Alex Bromley, Kanisha Lucille, Erica, Jess Krieger, Megan Bannister, Sarah, Courtney Daly, Jasmine Sepinen, Kayla Latondre, and Kat Duffy. Thank you all so much for your continued support of The Stacks. Okay, now it's time for The Stacks Book Club conversation of The New Wilderness by Diane Cook with our incredible guest, Van Newkirk. All right, everybody. Very excited. We are back with Van Newkirk, journalist, podcaster, all-around cool dude. And it's a Stacks Book Club day. So we're talking about The New Wilderness by Diane Cook. And before I say anything else, there will be spoilers on this episode. So if you have not finished the book, pause, go read it, come back. I don't want to be in trouble for ruining anything for any of you. And now, Van, welcome back.
Thank you. Thank you.
Okay, so we always basically start here with the book club episodes, which is like just generally overall, what did you think of the book?
I thought it was a like really fascinating way to talk about some of the anxieties we have about the environment and also about motherhood and parenthood. But some of the takeaways in the ending were a little bit confused for me. And so that's why, we'll talk about them eventually, but I thought the overall setup and framing and writing was beautiful. I'm just trying to figure out where exactly what happened in the end.
Okay. Yeah. I'm very much with you. I think for me overall, I was pleasantly surprised by this book. I don't really love fiction. Like fiction just doesn't always speak to me. And usually I'm like over it. Pretty early. But what I appreciated most about this book is I felt like I would never pick up a nonfiction book about like survival tactics and that kind of stuff. But I felt like I learned a lot of that in this book and was very interested by a lot of that stuff. I had issues with some of the pacing and like how, where she focused her energy sometimes. Like I sometimes was over B and Agnes and was much more interested in the kind of group dynamic and what was going on with like the power struggle. But I really liked her writing style. I thought it was great how she could use just like a sentence and describe the whole environment instead of talking about each leaf or grain of sand or whatever, which would have driven me absolutely crazy. So those are kind of like my general thoughts about the book. You do work in climate justice, environmental justice type stuff. And you said that this book was on kind of like one of the books you were planning to read next, which is why we picked it, because I was sort of intrigued by it too. I'd seen really good reviews about it. I'm curious how you approach something like this with your background in climate justice, like how you're looking at it, what you're thinking about, if at all, related to your kind of professional life.
So one, I think, interesting thing about me and how I approach these kind of stories especially is that I'm kind of over the big apocalypse as a framework for understanding at least climate change, because it's not how it will happen on Earth. That's not how people are currently experiencing it. You know, the idea of some major cataclysm and people, like, number one, you know, I'm not super concerned about capital H humanity and whether it survives or not, to be honest. I'm concerned about communities and whether they survive. And something happening now that's not even on the news could mean the end of a community. And that's important to me. You know, I don't know if I'm super worried about like the species surviving, because if I die, my family die, I don't really care about everybody else.
I mean, true.
Yeah, but like that framework, the big disaster, has been how we talk about climate in fiction often, and that's been the allegory. And so what was kind of refreshing about The New Wilderness is it was a couple steps away from like the most dramatic use of the big disaster. And the things that were happening that were driving people out of the city, it was kind of smart to me, because they were talking about all these really, you know, this cascade of smaller events that were slowly eroding a normal way of life. People were doing their best to adapt to it. But you could see like the really useful thing for me was how it showed how really mundane things can break down society. So the detail I always remember is at one point, when they're talking about new people moving out to the wilderness, they're like, we ran out of sand for concrete. And nobody thinks about this, but yes, there is a global looming sand shortage for building materials.
I didn't know that was real.
All the sand we use comes from like for that type of stuff. You can't take it from beaches and deserts. The most useful sand for building has to be eroded by water. And so it all comes from like river deltas. And we have dug up so much of the useful building sand in the world. And so stuff like that, like really small, you know, to me, the you know, one really good thing about the book was that Diane Cook is just into the weeds on lots of future bad things in the world.
She was into the weeds on a lot of stuff, like the detail of like the sinew that they were using and stuff. I was like, yo, I would never read about this if it was not like, it's like when you take your medicine, like a spoonful of sugar, like with the medicine, right? It's like, I would never know some of these details if it weren't for it being packaged kind of in this like literary fiction. But she went in on like the survival techniques and like all the little details. You could tell she geeked out on research for sure.
Yeah, but it's not like I'm going to teach you about, you know, survival. It's it's really, it is just presented as a matter of fact, as a matter of survival. And that's how it comes to the people in the first place.
Yeah.
And so that's, you know, it's not like it never comes across like, I read a whole lot of stuff about how to survive.
Right.
And I'm going to pack it in this book.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's what I liked about it. Yeah. I was like, let me just present you with the information, but there's no way I would even watch like a documentary about this. Like it was a great side effect of the book, and I'm glad I learned this stuff, but like it's something that if it wasn't presented this way, I would quickly move away from it. But then again, I also feel like if I was in this situation, I would have been dead quickly. Like I would have been one of the first people to go. I don't know. I don't think I could hang. Do you think you could hang?
I mean, I don't know. Everybody, I like to think that I could hang. And, you know, I like to think that growing up where I grew up and, you know, actually having killed animals before will do me good. But honestly, I figure if this ever happens, it'll be so chaotic that skills and all that experience doesn't really matter.
Yeah.
You know, there's moments in the book where people just die, and that's how it is. People just die.
Right. Yeah. I would definitely just die. I mean, some of the stuff that they were talking about, I was like, yeah, I'd have to be near someone who was a real survivalist. Like I would have to be paired with someone from Naked and Afraid or something, because I would truly be like, where is the Ritz-Carlton? I need to go.
Oh, see, yeah, I couldn't do Naked and Afraid. I mean, that's just that's a bad setup.
Yeah, no.
That's a bad setup.
Like, there are certain reality shows that I'm like, I can't even watch because this is my nightmare. Like, Survivor is pretty close to me for that. Like, I'm like, I don't even want to see you eating bugs. Like, no, it's a no for me. I like my reality television, like The Bachelor. I want a mansion. I want beautiful gowns. Like Aretha Franklin.
I like comfort.
Yes,
comfort's
exactly.
Great.
Exactly.
Yeah,
so I think, yeah, I would be out so quick in the new wilderness. I think I would have had to find a way to like become a ranger or something, because I could not hang in the like originalist group.
Oh yeah. Things are really rough for them. They talk about, you know, they look at all the newcomers at one point and they're like, you have all your fingers and toes. And I'm like, whoa, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, I like that.
Yeah. And I'd like to keep all of them. Thank you very much. Okay. So one of the things, like, I feel like one of the big parts of the book was the mother-daughter relationship and like Bea and Agnes. And for me, I was interested in that. But for whatever reason, like, I don't know. I just didn't think that that was nearly as like impressive to me as the stuff that was going on with the survival. I'm curious how you felt about those parts.
I was reading the book in search of a resolution to that dynamic.
Yeah.
And there is no resolution to that dynamic. And that's probably the point.
Yeah.
But coming to the end, I was definitely disappointed that there was no resolution.
Yeah.
And I was just like, oh, that's it. I think it is deliberately messy and deliberately complicated view of maternal relationships, mm-hmm. of just, you know, what the duty of a parent to a child is anyways.
Right.
And this is something, you know, I hate doing too much to find hidden meanings in stories. You know, I think we'd be better off in most cases by just reading what's in front of us. But yeah. I do think some of this was about the relationship between like humans and the earth.
Yes.
And so that I thought the relationship between Agnes and Bea was kind of like doing double duty to show the relationship between people and Mother Earth.
Right.
In some way. And so in that case, it felt a little, at least, even if it's not the intent of the author, giving that meaning to it made it feel a little bit more, made me feel a little bit more comfortable with the ambiguity.
Yeah. So then what do you think she's saying about our human relationship to the earth when you think of it in terms of Bea and Agnes, Bea being the earth and Agnes being the humans?
Well, I think it's, you know, love is not necessarily a uncomplicated thing, and it coexists with, passing harm and hurt back and forth. And even if, you know, Mother Earth loves humans or should love humans, the fact of the matter is that humans and our children are demanding and can be awful sometimes.
Right, right.
And yeah, people are, you know, you can't expect mothers to be saintly all the time.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm just thinking about it. I didn't really think about it in those terms, like with that analogy or whatever. But I do think that, like, I think that there's this expectation, and you're a parent also, that parents have to put their children first. And what does that actually look like when you're in, like, these really extreme life and death situations versus theoretically putting your child first? You know, like, theoretically, B was doing everything she could to help Agnes. However, in practice, I don't know. Like, it was a little more of a competitive relationship. Like, they were a little more equal than necessarily, like, mother-daughter or parent-child. And that part is the thing that stuck with me, I think, the most about their relationship. It's like, what's the difference between saying you put your child first versus actually putting your child first? And what does the child think of that? You know, like, if you asked Agnes, does B put you first? She'd probably be like, no.
Like, what? Yeah.
She'd be like, that woman does not even like me, you know? And if you ask B, she'd be like, I do. Everything I've ever done is for Agnes, you know? And so it's interesting. And then, of course, like, the part where she runs out on them when B leaves, like, that puts a really crazy wrench in that idea, because then she goes from being a mother to being a child, right? Like, that.
Right.
You remember that, like, all parents are also someone else's child. And so, I don't know, that moment was really great to me. Like, that, I did not really see that coming. And that whole scene, like, where they go to the camp and they, like, destroy everything and they're, like, eating out of the vending machine. And I'm just thinking, like, oh my God, you're all going to have such bad diarrhea because you are eating, like, processed sugar right now. And then she gets in the truck. And, like, that whole moment was really, I thought, one of my favorite, like, sections in the book.
Yeah, it was the one where I felt like the chaos just made the most. It was the best chaos.
Yeah, it came together in such a good way.
Yeah,
totally.
Yeah, I would always remember. I think of, if I remember anything from this book, you know, in years, it'll be the scene where right after that, Agnes's father feeds her roadkill that the truck ran over.
Oh yeah,
yeah, yeah.
Just so okay, disgusting. Yep, just yeah.
It's Carl, not Agnes's father. It's, Carl.
Yeah,
feeds him.
Carl. Yeah. Oh my gosh, Carl. I feel like I have so many things I want to talk about when it comes to Carl. Okay, let's just go, I guess, get into Carl first of all. Okay, wait, before we get into Carl, I want to get into the names really quickly. Did you happen to notice that all of the, like, women in the first group had three letter names, like Val, Deb, and B?
Yeah, Val, Deb, B.
And then all the guys were, it was like Carl, Juan, and Glenn, and they all had four letter names. And I was like, is this a thing? Like, is it? But I don't think it ended up being a thing, because when the newcomers came, they had different names. And I think, like, you know, the kids had, like, weird, like, pine cone or whatever the fuck. Was it pine cone?
Yeah, pine cone and brother and sister.
Brother and sister. But I was, like, trying to figure out why they all had three letter names. And, like, I don't know if there was a reason, but it definitely was a thing where I was like, what's happening with these names right now? But Carl. Okay. I hate Carl, but I also know exactly who Carl is. And I hate that person too. Like, Carl before they all have to go to the wilderness is exactly the guy that everyone hates, who definitely was, like, at the Capitol, like, in the insurrection, like, but didn't go inside, but was, like, standing on the steps, like, being like, we did it. Like, we're here. Right. Like, just so horrible.
Carl has strong YouTube energy.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That's Carl.
Oh my God. Carl loves explaining things to everyone.
And Carl is not. Carl thinks he's hot, and Carl is boo. Like, I just, every Carl definitely has like a golden retriever like avatar on his Twitter. Like, Carl is all of those things. And just the thought that he got to be like hot shit when they're in the wilderness is just like, makes my skin crawl.
And like, yeah, and the fun thing about Carl, you mentioned names, and the you know, I think the names do have some meaning. Like, Carl means free man.
Does it?
Yeah.
How do you know that?
I had a phase in life where I was really into names.
Oh, I thought you like Googled all of the names from this book. I take this podcast more seriously than I do.
No, I just know some of the like old, the really common names. Came from me looking at my own name.
Okay.
And lots of, you know, men's names or some variation of like, in some language, man or free man.
What does Van
or good,
mean?
Good man. That's so it's short for my great grandfather's name was Vander, which was obviously short for Evander, which means like good man.
Oh, okay. So you and Carl have similar names.
Similar, yeah.
But you seem language. Like an actual good man, and he seems like not a good man.
Well, his is free man. Well, let's be clear about that.
Okay, free man.
And that's why I think it's like, you know, it's like this. You think that the archetypes that are going to come out ahead are maybe going to be like the meathead or like the, you know, you got to be really physically strong or smart.
Right.
Carl is none of that.
None of it.
Carl is just like pure will to power. And
and
when he gets it, he does nothing with it. He just likes to be in power.
Right. Like, he just, yes, he does nothing with it. And he, except for try to starve Glenn to death. It's like, what are you doing? Like, the one person you're threatened by. But Glenn was like so useless anyways that it was like, why are you going after Glenn? Also, don't you know that you should be going after, you guys, you should be leading the group and not trying to destroy the one person who knows everything? Like, it's just so dumb and like mediocre and just like, ugh, Carl, get a grip.
But that's the point, I guess.
Right. It is.
Yeah.
It is. Like, I mean, Carl's like the reason we're all in the situation in the first place. You know, like if we're talking about B as Mother Earth and Agnes as the children, it's like Carl is capitalism. You know, like, he's the one who like doesn't get the game and is just fucking everything up kind of thing, you know?
But I also think it's funny that Carl is the one who needs the wilderness the most.
Right.
He is the one who it feels like would be the most unremarkable outside of it.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. For sure. That's such a good point. Yes. Like, that in the world where there's lots of competition and lots of people, he is just in the middle of the barrel, but he can assert himself in a certain way in the wilderness to give himself purpose or meaning, or so he thinks. And then, of course, Val, who just is like, you know, we all know
Val is too.
Yeah.
But Val changes.
Yeah. The thing about Val is that I think Val's playing a much smarter game than Carl. Like, she recognizes who and what Carl is to the group. And she's like into that because she understands what that means for her.
Yeah. And that's why she's trying so hard to have a baby by Carl.
Right. But then whose baby does she have? Is it Carl's or is it someone else?
I think it's Carl's. But
I thought Carl couldn't have children. I just decided.
That's probably so.
Like, I just thought maybe she ended up sleeping with someone else and got pregnant and then like carried it off as Carl's. But maybe Carl couldn't have kids.
That's probably right. Carl can't have kids. Now I see it. Yeah.
I feel like Carl can't have kids in my mind because fuck Carl. But, you know, whatever. Carl. I think the game of survival that B and Agnes are playing and like the different ways that they're playing it, and like that B's doing it a much more psychological, like, power dynamic game, and Agnes is just doing a straight like survival as leadership game was also really interesting to me. Like, the different, like, all the dynamics within the group I was very interested in. And like Agnes's purity and sort of holier than thou attitude versus B's like kind of more ruthless, like, you do what you need to do to get shit done. I appreciated that because I definitely see myself as more of a B than an Agnes. Like, I just feel like you play the game that's in front of you versus like trying to rewrite the rules. And I'm sure that, you know, in the long run, whatever Agnes was doing is probably better. But I felt like B was more compelling and more exciting to me. Like, that's the drama. I love drama.
Yeah. I mean, I think the takeaway is that there is no better.
Yeah.
Is that it's just, you know, people.
Everyone's.
There are no truly winning strategies in this game.
Right.
And right. Agnes is defined by having less of a tether to society. She doesn't give a shit about society or like overall group dynamics.
Right.
Or, you know, justice. She does not care.
Right.
And that is what really marks her, because a lot of the things people are bringing in their presuppositions about what's right or wrong are like totally alien to Agnes.
Right. And that's because
Agnes was old enough to remember that stuff.
But was she? Wasn't she only like 5?
I mean, still, you have a sense of she remembers ice cream, and you have some like sense of preschool right or wrong, at least at that point.
Right. But I felt like she did have a very like elementary understanding of like right and wrong. But I don't think like she clearly did not have a mature understanding of like human interaction and like desire versus, yeah, you know, all that kind of stuff. So I do feel like it makes sense because she was sort of raised, you know, in the wilderness. And so she doesn't get the power dynamics in the same way.
Yeah. And she's not seeing them as like political.
Right.
In the way, you know, yeah. I think B and Carl and Val and Glenn are playing like this really political game.
Mm-hmm.
And Agnes is like side-eyeing all of them because it's right. Like, you know, what is this?
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And one of the things I really love that Diane Cook does is that she sort of sets up Agnes early on as like being like really naturey and good at like following the animals and being quiet and sneaky. And then there's like a few different times throughout the book where B's like, yeah, stop following me. And she's like, how did she know I was there? And it's like, of course, yeah, because she's 9, you know, or like she's 12 and she thinks that she's like super stealth. Like, I definitely remember times like thinking I was like hiding and like eavesdropping on my parents on the phone or whatever. And my mom's like, get off the phone, like hang up the other line or whatever, you know? And I just loved that because it's just a reminder that like even whatever Agnes is sort of presenting to us isn't the full picture of what's going on. And she definitely is still a child, and she definitely she's not like this super wilderness warrior queen like she thinks that she is.
Right.
And I really like that.
I liked it because it felt like a better way to do the unreliable narrator thing. Because she's clearly an unreliable narrator, but she's not lying and she's not deluded. She's just presenting the world through a child's eye.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so a lot of the things she just simply believes to be true, you know, are directly proven not to be true. But it's not like they overturn, like it's not like she experienced him as like lying. It's just like, oh, wow, you know, my mom knew where I was.
Right. Right. Yeah. Like, it's like she just has such a narrow view of what's going on. And so it's true to her. But it's so narrow, and it is it ends up being unreliable to us because we need to see, we're seeing a bigger picture of like what's going on and how things are working. Let's take a quick break and then we'll be back because I want to talk about some like symbolism, which I never do, but I think we have to.
Okay.
It's important to me that the supplements I take are of the highest quality, and that's why for almost 4 years now, I have been drinking AG1. Unlike many supplement brands, AG1 is constantly searching for how to do things better. They're at 52 iterations of their formula and counting. Their team is always trying to find better ways to source, test, and find the best quality ingredients available. So many people have asked me if AG1 is actually the real deal. And trust me, there's a reason why I've been drinking it for so long. Quality for AG1 isn't just a buzzword. It's a commitment backed by expert-led scientific research, high-quality ingredients, industry-leading manufacturing, and rigorous testing. At each step of the process, AG1 goes above and beyond industry standards. I know I can trust what's in every scoop of AG1 because they totally obsess over product quality, the standards of manufacturing partners, and sustainable practices. Taking care of my health shouldn't be complicated, and AG1 simplifies this by covering my nutritional bases and setting myself up for success in just 60 seconds each morning. AG1 ingredients are heavily researched for efficacy and quality, and I love that every scoop also includes vitamin C and zinc to support my immune system, which is so important for me, especially with the germs that the mini stacks have running around and going to a cesspool called preschool. I've stayed partnered with AG1 for so long because they make such a high quality product, and I genuinely look forward to drinking it every single day. So if you want to replace your multivitamin and more, start with AG1. Try AG1 and get a free 1-year supply of vitamin D3 and K2 and 5 free AG1 travel packs with your first subscription at drinkag1.com/thestacks. That's drinkag1.com/thestacks. Check it out.
Let's face it, people have different sleep needs. While you love your partner, sleeping next to them might not always be the most comfortable. Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs, so you can choose what's right for each of you whenever you like. Maybe you prefer a firmer mattress and your partner needs something softer. Because of the individualized comfort that you get from Sleep Number Smart Beds, you and your partner will sleep better together. All Sleep Number Smart Beds feature cooling, pressure-relieving comfort layers for soothing sleep throughout the night. And their temperature balancing bedding is designed to move heat and moisture away when you're hot. When you're cool, they hold their energy to help warm you. The smart beds even automatically respond and adjust to your movements, so you sleep comfortably all night long. JD Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For JD Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app today to get free delivery on your first 3 orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
All right, we're back from our break. We're going to talk about some sort of symbolism-y things. I don't even know if that's the right word. Well, first of all, I feel like this book is a kind of book that would be taught in school, because I feel like an English teacher could really go ham on like all of the symbolism and like the allegory and the analogies and all. It just like, I don't know that I understood a lot of it, but I feel like it's rich with that kind of stuff, you know?
Yeah. I mean, at the end, the last quarter of the book is about going to a mountaintop.
Yeah.
Which is pretty symbolic.
Yeah. Yeah. In my mind, so okay, you set up a thing that I hadn't thought about, which is like B as Mother Earth and then Agnes as humans. But in my mind, I also felt like the originalists, right, are like the natives of whatever the land is, sort of, and then the newcomers are like the Americans, right? Like they're just like peak American to me. They just felt like so, like they come in and they're like Converse sneakers and like their jellies like they have like their nail polish and like all this stuff, and I just was like, you guys are so unprepared for this conversation. Like when we talk about climate justice, like now it's like Americans are like, we can't even get on board that this is happening as a country, let alone like do anything about it. Whereas like in other countries, they're actively like trying to make changes in their culture and like do things. And in America, it's like, depends on who's in charge of the government, whether we believe in science, you know? And like that to me was just like, I just saw them and was like, I hate them because they're us. And now I feel bad about myself.
Yeah, and you can see as they, you know, there's more and more signs littered throughout the wilderness and in the book that, like, there's just this steady, overwhelming tide of people slowly moving into the wilderness.
Yeah.
last of a wilderness.
Yeah.
And, you know, you see where it's going. I mean, like a third of the way through the book, there's like a flash forward and the narrator says there is no more wilderness state. So you know where it's going.
Yeah.
But it's just, I think it's interesting how ominously like those signs are seeded throughout the book.
Right.
It's like, oh, you know, we see these, you have the newcomers and you have like the
Mavericks.
Yeah, the Mavericks are the real, and you know, obviously Americans' usage of maverick is part of this, right?
Right. I can't hear that word and not think of Sarah Palin.
Yeah, Sarah Palin, John McCain.
Yeah, like that, just those words are inextricably linked in my mind. Like those two people and that word just locked in.
Yeah, maverick is like a synonym of pioneer.
Right.
It's basically you have lots of pioneers who are kind of just like leeching off of the people, the originalists who are there. And also the fun thing for me is like originalist feels like number one, the people who were referred to as originalists in America are like the conservative people who believe the Constitution was written and could, you know, cannot be changed.
Right.
So there's like that's also American and kind of even biblical.
Right.
I don't know. Yeah. It's clearly symbolic and meant to invoke this idea of like successions of people and their differing relationships to the land.
Right. I guess, I mean, I think in another interpretation, like from what I just said, is also that if you think of all of the people as part of like one community, like you're saying, the originalists become a certain kind of, you know, like founding fathers type, like we set the rules and this is our place. And there's this ownership over this thing that is not theirs. And then the newcomers then become the people who are trying to push back a little bit against that or like make changes. And then the Mavericks are just like, we're here to do our own shit and we don't want to follow anybody's rules. They're like the libertarians or whatever. Yeah.
Like fuck that.
Right.
Yeah. Each generation is a little bit further away from the holy rule book. Right.
Right. Right. And like the thing that's so of course about the Mavericks is like the guy that ends up showing up who is a Maverick or whatever. It's like he only shows up because he needs something from them. You know, he needs and wants like and is there to steal. And like, you know, it's that same sort of entitlement. That's Carl if Carl hadn't gotten picked to be an originalist, right? Like if Carl couldn't have gotten in on his own, that's what Carl would have done.
That was, you know, I felt like it was the most heavy-handed symbolism. Adam.
Yeah. Oh, Adam. Of course, that was his name.
Adam, and his behavior was just like so openly, you know, tipping the hand of what the symbol was. He goes and sleeps in their bed.
Right.
And, you know, just is like appropriative of everything they have and own, is totally just doesn't care about any of their customs or rules. Mm. I think like the what really got me was him sleeping in their bed while they were in it.
Right.
Him sleeping in Deb's bed. And it's like, oh, but yeah, that's me. And then he makes off with like their most prized possession,
which is a cast iron.
Even though he cannot even really like carry it or even benefit from it,
right?
The way they can, he carries it off just because it's valuable,
right? Right.
Yeah. And yeah. Of course, he's Adam.
Right. And then and then the last like sort of group of people that I feel like is part of this sort of new wilderness ecosystem is the Rangers, led by the person that we're supposed to love, Bob. But
Bob
yeah. really. Bob really hurt
Don't
me.
Love Bob.
Bob
Don't
hurt
love
me Bob. Deeply. First of all, B, stealing all the fucking lollipops, you snake. Okay, B, that's not cool. Those were for your daughter. She wanted candy. She didn't even know she wanted candy because she'd never even had it, which I thought was really sneaky. But the Rangers and the symbolism, there's like a few ways to look at them, but mostly they're just like the government, right? Like they're...
Yeah.
That's what I mean, that was pretty obvious because they work for whatever administration, I think is what they called it, whichever, you know, new administration. But you know, again, it's like the police, you know, again, it's like these people who are no different, no better, no smarter, just connected or whatever. And that's how they get their job as a ranger. There's, you know, it's not as, you know, Carl was what, one sentence away from being able to be one. If he had said that he wanted to enforce the rules, he would have been a ranger. Like, he's no different than these people. They just have power and benefit, which is sort of, you know, like how I view the police. Like, the police are trained to be terrible, and they, but they're really, if they hadn't been police officers, they could have been something else, you know. Like, I don't know if I'm saying this right, but I, my point being is, like, the institution of policing is what is so corrupt and terrible, and it attracts certain people. But anyone, like Van, if you wanted to be a police officer, you could be a police officer, but you'd have to, I guess, want to be a police officer. Sort of,
it's
my
not
point.
A, like, it's not a position that requires a whole lot of existing skill. Yeah. Right.
Like, you learn the job when you get there, and you, and anyone conceivably can do the job. You just have to be willing to buy into the job. And unfortunately, the job means being a fucking dick, you know. Like, the job means forcing people to wander all over the wilderness for months on end, and then telling them, oh, sorry, you're in trouble now, you have to go somewhere else. Like, but that doesn't, anyone can do that. And it just,
see, that's why I thought, if we're really, you know, reaching into the allegory bag here,
okay, go.
I think the rangers are angels.
Interesting.
Like Old Testament angels. And I think a lot of the magic,
they're like evil, because Old Testament angels are like mean and like,
well, they're like capricious. They just, like, there's a plan, and, you know, Old Testament God does not care about whether you whether you understand the plan, whether it makes sense to you. And it really, like, feels to me a lot of like around Exodus.
Ooh.
A lot of the plan is like, you know, you get a map. The map may or may not make sense to you. You know, you got to do a long walk to whatever lower middle post. Right. And it's terrible. It's shitty. People may not even be in there when you get there. Right. And the angel, the reason why it felt like angels to me is because they don't really have any. They just sort of appear.
That's true.
They appear out of the wilderness. Right.
Right.
And they are different. You know, they have different personalities, but no real backstories. And they're just there to be representatives of some higher administration, capital
A. Right.
That appears to change several times.
Yes.
Or at least change its mind several times over the course of story, but still is like this indecipherable, impossibly far off thing that is, you know, dictating the lives of these people in the wilderness by whim, it appears. So that seems like it feels like they are angels.
Yeah, I mean, that's really good. That's really good. I do not have any biblical knowledge myself. And so I would definitely totally miss that. But I feel like, you know, what little I've seen of the Prince of Egypt film, I know I'm a little Old Testament here and there. I did go to Catholic school, but, you know, I didn't really go to Catholic school. I didn't really do much Catholic stuff. But I do see, because, like, you know, I guess, people always talk about in the Old Testament that God is like a pretty vicious, can be a pretty vicious God, a pretty
he's a God of vengeance.
Yes, vengeful. And, that's right. That's an interesting take. So then the administration then is, in that analogy, is God.
Yes, the administration is God.
And then the originalists are sort of Moses and the Jews wandering for 40 years in the desert.
Yep.
But there's no end of the 40 years in the same
there's
way.
There's no end.
The end so, is a yeah, little different.
Yeah. There is no promised land.
Yeah, there's no promise.
Obviously, like, private lands are the allegory for the promised land. There's no promised land here.
Did you think that the private lands were real as you were reading, or did you think it was made up?
See, this is one thing I'm going to take credit for. I knew that the wilderness was going to become the private land. And that's actually when I started kind of building the biblical or the, you know, Old Testament allegory in my head, because like the land they were on was what was actually promised.
I see. Oh, that's so good. Okay. Yeah. But did you, but so you knew then that that meant that the private lands didn't already exist.
Yeah.
That
and everybody, you know, I knew that it didn't exist. It felt to me like there was some confusion in the middle where people, when they first start seeing some of the newcomers and you know, new people are in there who are like, yeah, the private lands definitely exist. And they never explain exactly what they are. Mm. And I actually think that a lot of the people coming in are coming in on the assumption that they don't believe the wilderness and private lands to be different places.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
In my mind, the private lands was like a really great resort, like La Quinta, where they filmed The Bachelorette, you know, like somewhere really nice, like lots of little casitas or something. That's what it was in my mind. So in my mind, it was different than the wilderness because, again, for me, the wilderness is not a promised land or a private land. The wilderness is one of my many nightmares. So in my mind, I created, you know, a lovely place with a pool and a spa. But I also knew that the private lands were not real. Like, I never bought into the private lands thing. It just felt like the kind of fairy tale, you know, that people have and say. Okay. I know you said that you had some kind of like what happened at the end. And I definitely want to talk about sort of the unraveling of the whole thing, which I think probably starts with Glenn's death. Right.
Yes.
Like that's like the beginning of the unraveling. So do we think that Glenn's death was an accident, or do we think that Carl did something to him when they went away together to do whatever the fuck they did?
I think it was a mutually understood not accident.
Yes, I agree.
Yeah. I think Glenn wanted out.
I think it was slightly more malicious than that. I think that Carl did something to Glenn, and then Glenn realized that he was never going to have the peace to just be in the wilderness and just be like dead weight for everybody. And so he was like, I just need to die. So like, I think that Carl pushed it, but I don't think that Glenn fought it. Whatever it okay. was. That's sort of in my mind.
That makes sense. I mean, that would make sense to me with their characters.
Yeah.
I mean, I knew when they went off. Like,
yes, it was
Glenn,
over.
Glenn was a dead man.
Yeah, it was like, Glenn, what the fuck are you doing? Like, I guess to your point, Glenn agreeing to go was Glenn being like, yeah, I'm cool with dying now.
Yeah. And I think everybody knew. Except Agnes.
Well, even Agnes knew. She was like, or was it B who was like, don't go, don't go.
B was like,
don't go. I mean, yes. Definitely, I think in a lot of ways, B is the reader also. Like, because we understand the politics. Like, we have a greater understanding than Agnes. So Agnes is, again, like we said, unreliable to us. But B is a much more, you know, is a better avatar for the reader, I think, in most cases. Okay. So Glenn dies. We start to have the unraveling. Do we think that they kept the wilderness open out of respect to Glenn? And so when they found out that Glenn died or whatever, then they were like, great, we can close it? Or do you think that those things were unrelated?
I had not thought about them keeping open for Glenn until you just mentioned it.
Okay, so probably
of course
not.
He was the progenitor of the experiment. So maybe. But yeah, I think by the time he died, it was out of hand already.
Yeah.
And shortly after that, they peel back and say, you know, the wilderness is basically gone anyways.
Right.
Yeah. There's just been so many people already trampling it right. That it's you know, a park.
I mean, it's also like that metaphor or whatever, it's barely a metaphor, it's pretty straightforward, but it's like humans can't do anything. Like, humans can't just be part of any ecosystem. Like, we just have to ruin everything as quickly as possible. I don't know. I just that's like one of the questions I have about the book, which is like, can humans be in, like, we used to be, like, Native American folks were out or Native people in all parts of the world were out just living off the land in a way that they were part of the ecosystem. But is that just not, that's just never going to be possible again, is what this book is saying.
See, I guess I come at this question of, you know, what is wilderness?
Sure.
From a bit of a different angle. So it's that's one place where I'm not sure the book was convincing to me.
Okay.
Or maybe it was, you know.
Okay.
But I think even you look at like hunter-gatherer societies, mm-hmm. People have always changed the environment mm-hmm. in ways that moved away from pure wilderness, whatever you want to call it.
Sure.
And I don't know if pure wilderness exists really ever.
Right.
Because all animals, including people, exert their will in the environment and change right. it and leave their waste. It just so happens that people have, and sometimes, you know, plastic waste. There is no, you know, no matter how advanced in putting plastic and glass and steel bubbles we get, the air inside those bubbles are still the environment.
Right.
And so, like, we're always part of the environment.
Sure.
The question for me is, you know, how do we steward that in a way that protects biodiversity, that makes it, you know, that preserves resources for future generations? I'm not totally interested in the idea of pure wilderness because I don't think it exists.
Sure.
Yeah. Sure. And so that is, I mean, that is kind of the point of the end of this piece, which is like people inhabiting an environment are always going to exert their will in the environment. There's right. just no way around it.
Right.
You know, if you consider a wilderness to be a place without people, then by definition, a place with people will cease to be wilderness.
Sure. I guess my yeah. question then for you is sort of like, to your point, is if every creature or living thing in any environment is sort of, you know, definitely shapes the environment, why can't the humans just live in balance with the other things, right? Like, I don't know. I feel like when I used to go on outdoor ed trips as kids, I used to talk about how like bears eat berries and then the berry seeds like grow and whatever. I don't know, like from their stool and all this stuff. So like, why can't the humans be like that? Like, or can they?
Well, a lot of that's bullshit.
Okay, great.
A lot of that's
Thank
bullshit.
You.
And
as you can tell, I'm super science-minded.
Animals, all living creatures exploit their environment to the degree that they can.
Right.
And so, you know, I think it used to be way more bison in America than like we could actually support as a landmass.
Okay.
And you know, there was no like circle of life shit going on. It was just like climatic changes and stuff cut down all the trees, and white explorers cut down all the trees, and there was a bison explosion.
Right.
Because bison there will be as many bison as, you know, can eat. Right. And that's basically the equation that governs every single living creature on Earth, is there will be as many as can eat. As can eat comfortably.
Right.
And humanity is no different. The right. only real difference is we have the intellectual means to dramatically increase the amount that we can eat.
Right.
And so what's important to me though, is that we also have the intellectual means to decide that we would like to create an Earth, even if it is not wilderness, where, you know, as many creatures can live as possible, where we can for the first time really create a system where we don't exploit to the fullest of our abilities
right.
the Earth.
But to your point then, that would mean like really going against our nature, if you will.
well, I don't know.
Our
I mean,
human
I think,
nature. Well, if I think all there animals... have been,
some are, human groups have already made this decision.
They have.
Yeah. And have in history and have decided that they wanted to become stewards of their, of the land where they live, that they wanted to prioritize future generations of people.
Mm-hmm.
Even if they did not care about animals per se.
Right, right,
they
right.
They want to live in a way that preserve things for their descendants.
Right. But that still is like, that's an active choice against instinct is sort of what I'm saying. Like, yes, to do that, humans would have to go against our animal or whatever instincts, our human instincts, to exploit and to create more and more until we can no longer eat. Like, to live in balance or to be stewards of our environments or anything like that is an active choice. It's not something that is just going to happen, is sort of what I'm saying, getting
at. Choice, but I'd like to frame it as people prioritizing one set of instincts over another.
Yes.
So we do have a set of instincts to dominate, create dominion, to destroy. Mm-hmm. But we also have a set of instincts that binds us to our kin and our future kin. And that actually binds us to nature and says that, you know, people like sunsets, people like watching the waves, people like swimming in pristine waters. You know, those are instinctual things.
Yes.
And for me, it means prioritizing the instincts, certain instincts over others.
Okay. I really like that. Okay. Back to the ending. We have to talk about the ending because I know everyone at home is also like, what the fuck happened? Okay. So what was your big question with the unraveling? Like, what were you hung up on?
Number one, what happens to B?
Okay. Yeah.
I mean, maybe it's not important, but I want to know what happens to B. And I guess it just feels like there's so much happening, like the last 20, 30 pages. Mm-hmm. And it accelerates so quickly that I am still trying to, I'm reeling a little bit. So, you know, over the course of those pages, Agnes becomes a surrogate mother, an adoptive mother, rather.
Yeah.
For Fern. And
I forgot about that.
Yeah. And like, it's about her becoming a mother, but it's just so quick. I'm like, well, you know, what does Agnes actually think about this? What does Fern think about this?
Right.
What are their motivations? And I don't believe I understand them.
Yeah. I don't know. You're right. I have no idea. I feel like my mind sort of shut down at the end because I barely even remember Fern. Fern spoke Spanish, maybe?
Spoke Spanish.
And she like found her. And then like everybody ended up having kids, right? Like everybody ended up adopting like children when they would like, and they were whistling and like meeting up and all that stuff. Yeah. I don't know what happened to everybody. I wrote down like what happened to the people who stayed, like Carl and them who tried to make the deal, and then what happened to B, and then what happened to Jake and all the runners. And I don't know, I sort of feel like everyone just got killed by the Rangers. That was like the way that I did it, but I don't know that that's true. It just feels like I definitely feel like the people who stayed got killed. I think that the Rangers were like, or at least like beat up or like imprisoned or something. I think something really bleak happened to those people.
I think they at some point it pulls back and we get an omniscient narrator, and it's like they did deal roughly with some people more roughly than they did with Agnes,
right?
And I do believe some people, I definitely believe Carl's dead.
Bye, Carl, get a life.
Carl's dead. But like I also think that they probably split up the different resettlement places, so right. They wouldn't be able to develop the same communities in them.
Right.
But also, it's just like the last bit is just so intentionally chaotic.
Right.
That, yeah, it's hard to have any takeaways from it.
Yeah. I do feel like the ending sort of ended up being like too many endings. And so there wasn't really an ending. And I do think that it sort of like did the book overall a disservice. Because I felt like she was building towards something and I felt like she had a lot of ideas of how it could end. And then it ended up having all of those endings instead of sort of like making a choice and picking one. And so the ending sort of in my mind feels chaotic, like you said, or like it doesn't, like I'm not really clear at all what happened. And I also wonder what happened to the rest of humanity that wasn't in the wilderness. Like, where did those people go? Are they still in the city? Is the city even worse? Like, were the resettlement camps in the city or were they outside the city? Like, it's just like a lot of questions. And I feel like for a book that was long and detailed, it got really unspecific. And I think that's where the chaos came from for me.
That's where it was for me. You know, it was so incredibly detailed up until that point that I lost a lot, you know, the fidelity. You lose a lot of fidelity right there. And it was just,
So I don't know. I guess in my mind, B is dead also.
I think B is alive.
Oh, you do? Do you think she's really running around in the wilderness like those people who said that they saw her or whatever?
Actually, I do.
Okay. So you think she got to stay in the wilderness alone?
Yeah.
She's like the lone
wilderness. Even if she is dead, there's something about her becoming like the spirit of...
Okay.
Yeah. But I think she's alive and like the last person in the wilderness. Person who believes it's a wilderness.
Right. And then Jake and all the other runners, like I think it was Val ran, I think Deb ran, those people, you think that they got captured and are in different resettlement camps spread out?
Yes.
Okay. I could go with that. And then the people who stayed, some of them are in resettlement camps and some of them are dead like Carl.
Yeah. And it's just, I mean, I guess that's the final bit of like America allegory is like, they put all the people who live there in weird camps while they built houses for everybody else there.
Right.
Which is very, I mean, maybe that's why it's so weird to me, because it's, you know, just dumb, a dumb thing to do, but it is mirroring real dumb things that
we do in America. Yeah.
Yeah.
One of the things you mentioned was the foreshadowing of the ending of the wilderness not being there anymore. And I took that foreshadowing. I did not see that that was going to become the promised land. I took that to just mean that the humans ended up all coming and just overrunning it. Like, I just thought it was going to be like, or that the administration, out of some type of vengeance, just like burned the whole shit down and was like, we can't have nice things, or we need this space to create more city or something like that. Like, my thinking was a more like a repercussion to bad behavior by the people in the wilderness, and less of a, we need these resources for the rich people, which I should have probably thought of because that's the obvious answer. But I had some like more convoluted, I think, roundabout way of getting to an ending with no wilderness.
But if you believe the private land idea, it's just, you know, enclosure of space for rich folks.
Right.
For me, like, it was like light
bulb. Obvious. Yeah. You say it, it's so obvious to me. I like did, you know, like there's like the A to B route, and I did like A to Z to Q to L to P to B. And I was like, okay, I'm here. Okay. We have to wrap up because it's basically time. But first two questions. One is, do you think this would be a good movie or TV show?
Oh, I think it'd be great.
I do too.
Probably a TV show.
I think it'd be great.
Yeah. It feels a little ambiguous to be a movie to me, but like a TV show would be a good one, because then, you know, you could basically string along people like you do The Walking Dead.
Yeah.
You never have to end until you want to end.
Right. It's kind of like Lost, but without the supernatural elements, maybe.
Right. Well, it's kind of, I could see a little bit of supernatural at least.
Yeah.
And what people believe, but yeah, you know, it's formulaic in the way that like a Lost or a Walking Dead is.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I have two more questions still. I lied. I do really briefly want to talk about, what did you imagine that the people looked like racially? Did you feel like it was a diverse group? Did that ever cross your mind? Did you envision white people? Did you envision black people? Like, did you have any real sense of that? At all?
See, that's one place where I just don't know. I mean, I know she in some places describes people's skin color, but like the descriptions are just so opaque to me. I have, they don't create any mental image in my mind of what, like, some people's skin is like some type of bark and some people's like wet sand. That meant nothing to me.
Yeah.
I just, in my mind, they were all white.
In my mind, they were mostly white too, but I couldn't tell if she was trying to do that thing that's like, in the future, there's been so much miscegenation that we're all the same and like there is no race. Like, I couldn't tell if that's what she was trying to get at.
I just want people to describe people's skin color using real colors.
Yeah.
For me, there's lots of different types of wet sand. I don't really get a, I cannot place what a person looks like based on wet sand.
Right. Right.
Yeah. Maybe the point was that I wasn't important, I guess, but
it's important to me. Like, it's important to me to know what kind of people are getting picked to go to the wilderness, you know, like,
yeah, especially for like apocalyptic stories. I have this joke that, you know, Black people don't exist in the future.
Right.
Because in so many different like post-apocalyptic, especially post-apocalyptic stories that have a message,
yeah,
or dystopian stories that have a message, they so often like, there just seems to be some common cataclysm in every single post-apocalyptic or dystopian story where all the Black people just die at some point.
Yeah.
And that's the apocalypse to me.
Right. Yeah. Right.
And there are just no Black people in the future.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So I think,
and I don't know if that's true of this book because I can't tell.
It seems like, I feel like there was one person, one of the twins, I feel like one of the twins was very dark skinned and one of the twins was very light skinned. I feel like she said something like
that. And that was the joke. That was a gag. Yeah,
that was the joke. So there's like one possibly Black person or like dark brown person who was a joke, which of course is always how it is. But I do feel like there was at least one possible Black person in this book. Okay. The last thing that we always end on is just the title of the book and the cover. So the title is The New Wilderness, and then the cover is blue and has pink birds, maybe like fighting in the air type vibe. What do you think of those things?
Number one, I thought it's a good signal of what the book is, for one, which is not always a case of book covers.
Yes.
It's green and it's, you know, that's the usual symbol for environment.
Right.
Originally it looked to me like there was a reflection of one bird, but now it's clear that there's two birds that are fighting for something. And I guess that's evocative of what the book is about, right?
Yeah, I guess. For me, first of all, I see the color of the background as not green, but more blue in my color scope. So for me, I actually don't think the cover is very clear about what the book is about. Like, I think it's interesting that you feel like it is, because to me, I was like, I don't know. Like, sure, there's things in nature on the book, but like, it didn't, I don't know. I think like in my mind, when I think of the book, I think of a lot of brown and green. So the blue and the pink didn't really match for me, of like how I experienced, like the colors I was thinking of when I was reading the book were very brown and green. And the birds also, like, I don't remember there being that many birds even in the book. Like, I was sort of
there were no birds. There was like geese one
yeah
time.
And I feel like wasn't there something like maybe circling up above at one point or something. I don't know. I think the cover is beautiful though, like as a piece of art. I think it's really gorgeous. As a cover for this particular book, it didn't really connect to me. And then we talked a little bit about the title, sort of like The New Wilderness, and wandering in the wilderness and all of that. So like, I think the title is good, and I think that the title, I like that the title is very straightforward. Like, I think it, and I think it's interesting, and it made me want to read the book. Like, when I saw the title, I was like, ooh, I'm interested in this book. So overall, I think it's good, but the cover isn't my favorite. The cover I think is beautiful, but it's not my favorite for the book, if you will.
Yeah. The cover, I mean, I think the title is great because it is, the old wilderness, again, you know, extending the Bible talk a little bit, you know, let's see, I think the God told Aaron to go into the wilderness, to see Moses.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So it's clearly, you know, that's the old wilderness. That's the old idea of it. And this, the endeavor here is to, you know, talk about a new version of that to me.
Yeah. And I'm so glad you brought in all this biblical stuff, because I would have missed so much of it. I'm so glad you know your Bible.
Sorry.
Shit.
This is the, you know, several summers of Bible camp, Van.
I love it. Truly, I would have missed so much of the book if not for having you be here today to discuss it in this way, because I don't think about the Bible. Like, I didn't go to Bible camp, obviously. but I think it adds like a layer, and I'm sure Diane Cook was thinking about that stuff too, obviously. I don't think you titled, I guess, a book anything to do with wilderness, a fiction book, unless you're thinking, I guess, of the wandering in the wilderness. I think that's a pretty strong choice.
Yeah, it was. It's pretty clear to me. I know my Christian allegory.
Okay.
And so I think it's at least Abrahamic.
Yeah.
Allegory. Yeah.
I love it. Well, Van, this was so great. Thank you so much for being here.
Well, thank you for having me.
And everyone else, we will see you in the stacks. Thank you so much to Van for being our guest. Okay, here it is, your announcement for the Stacks Book Club pick for March. We'll be reading Everybody Looking by Candice Eloe. It's a YA novel in verse. We're mixing things up around here. So be sure to tune in next Wednesday to find out who our guest will be. Please make sure you're subscribed to the Stacks wherever you listen to your podcasts. And if you're listening through Apple Podcasts, take a moment to leave us a rating and a review. For more from the Stacks, follow us on social media at the Stacks Pod on Instagram and at the Stacks Pod _ on Twitter. And check out our website, thestackspodcast.com. Sebastian Alcala is our sound editor and producer. Our graphic designer is Robin McCrite, and our theme music is from Tegirigis. The Stacks is created and produced by me, Tracy Thomas.